prophets to die for. The pharmaceutical and the medical cartel's historical preference was to test dangerous drugs and medical procedures on people of color. But by the late 1990s, black Americans were increasingly suspicious of medical authorities. President Clinton's belated 1996 official apology to the victims of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, 1935 through 1973, had reminded blacks of other historic atrocities, including the barbaric gynecological experiments on black women by Dr. J. Marion Sims, father of modern gynecology. In 1992, a Los Angeles Times expose revealed that the CDC had been conducting unlicensed experiments with the deadly flu vaccine on black children in Haiti and Cameroon, and on 1,500 black children in South Central Los Angeles beginning in 1986. Blacks were therefore understandably reluctant to sign up for clinical trials. Despite vigorous efforts by pharmaceutical companies and regulators to recruit blacks, fewer than 4% of clinical trial enrollees in America were black. Nevertheless, Dr. Fauci seemed to have a genius for finding blacks, both American and African, to participate in his HIV chemotherapy drug experiments. In 2003, an HIV-positive African-American mother in Memphis, Tennessee, died during one of Dr. Fauci's nevirapine drug trials. In April of that year, Joyce Ann Hafford, 4 months pregnant and already the mother of a gifted 13-year-old, was shocked to learn she had tested positive following a routine HIV test recommended by her pediatrician. Believing her diagnosis to be a death sentence, Hafford enrolled in DAIDS's clinical trial at the University of Tennessee in hopes of saving her soon-to-be-born son from getting AIDS. Dr. Fauci's local PI, Dr. Edwin Thorpe, planned to recruit 440 pregnant women to determine the treatment-limiting toxicities of four HIV drugs in pregnant women. "It's an embarrassment to me, to my family, and particularly to my deceased aunt and godmother, that NIH's Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development was a collaborator in this fraud." Hafford was healthy and symptom-free. None of her subsequent tests ever showed any clinical markers for AIDS, and Dr. Thorpe never told Hafford that the HIV test measured only for the presence of antibodies and was not a reliable indicator of HIV infection. Furthermore, pregnancy frequently triggers false positive results on HIV antibody tests, and Dr. Thorpe tested Hafford only once. To make matters worse, her family later found out that Joyce never signed her consent form, suggesting that Dr. Thorpe never informed her of nevirapine's risks. Hafford's health took a steep nosedive after her first dose of nevirapine. It only took a few days before Hafford was showing undeniable signs of dwindling liver function. Instead of taking her off the drugs that he knew could be deadly, Dr. Thorpe prescribed cortisone cream for her skin rashes. Within weeks, Hafford was presenting with alarming signals of hepatic collapse. 41 days after starting the trial, she was dead from liver failure, the same injury about which both FDA and JAMA had issued clear warnings. On July 29th, doctors delivered her baby, Sterling, by C-section 3 days before Joyce died. When the shattered family gathered around her body, Dr. Thorpe and his team told them, to their bewilderment, that Joyce had died of rapidly progressed AIDS. They were lying. The year after her passing, Associated Press reporter John Solomon gave Joyce's family a trove of DAIDS reports he had obtained from a Freedom of Information Act request. In those internal memos, DAIDS officials openly acknowledged to one another that nevirapine caused Joyce Hafford's liver to fail. Dr. Thorpe and his colleagues kept Sterling on AZT for 3 months. 15 months later, Sterling tested negative for HIV. Despite their repeated requests, Dr. Thorpe and his hospital refused to release Sterling's medical records to the Haffords. Sterling's family believes that NIAID withheld those records because they would prove that neither Joyce nor Sterling ever had HIV. All babies born to mothers with HIV test positive at birth, and almost all babies shed the maternal antibodies by 18 months. Celia Farber, who focused her Harper's expose on Joyce's death and the HIV-NET cover-up, is still angry. Farber, who grew close to the Hafford family during the months she spent researching Nevirapine, blames Dr. Fauci directly. The death of Joyce Ann Hafford in Memphis was a methodical, calculated homicide of a black woman by Fauci's henchmen, Farber told me. They had to know they were killing her when they saw her go into jaundice, and they just watched her liver crash. They wouldn't let her off the Nevirapine. It seemed like very clear medical murder at Dr. Fauci's doorstep. I'm still trying to recover from it. At that time, Dr. Jonathan M. Fishbein, M.D., was DAID's first director of the Office for Policy and Clinical Research Operations. His job was to monitor and enforce compliance to federal research and ethical policy in DAIDS-sponsored studies. In the summer of 2003, he intervened in Hafford's case. According to Dr. Fishbein, DAID's medical staff always knew that Hafford died of Nevirapine toxicity. Nevirapine's toxicity, Dr. Fishbein told me, particularly its association with liver failure, was well documented, and the PI certainly had that knowledge. That August, Dr. Fishbein sent a memo to Dr. Fauci's AIDS branch director, Ed Tremont, informing him that Nevirapine caused Hafford's lethal liver failure. Tremont wrote back, "Ouch, not much we can do about dumb docs." Tremont's glib riposte seems to have been like a subtle signal to Dr. Fishbein to get in line with NIAID's strategic cover-up. Dr. Fishbein told me that acknowledging Nevirapine's role in Hafford's death would have jeopardized Nevirapine's FDA approval. Despite Tremont's crass cipher, Dr. Fishbein's regulatory team nevertheless informed the FDA about Hafford's drug-related death. Hafford was not the only trial recruit to suffer. In the initial Phase 1 trial on 21 pregnant women, NIAID's investigators would later report that 4 of 22 infants died and 12 suffered serious adverse events. Furthermore, the studies suggested that Nevirapine was ineffective. None of the women experienced reduction of viral loads. When Thorpe and his colleagues finally published the results of their Nevirapine study in 2004, they acknowledged that the study was suspended because of greater than expected toxicity. Rooting out integrity in the workplace. Dr. Fishbein didn't last long in his official capacity as the DAIDS official in charge of enforcing compliance with clinical research and ethical policy. His lethal misstep was his decision to follow a trail of irregularities affecting a NIAID drug trial called Esprit, which tested interleukin-2, IL-2, a cancer chemotherapy and AIDS drug known by its brand name Proleukin. The Esprit study was investigating IL-2 clinical outcomes in individuals with asymptomatic HIV+. In December 2003, the Esprit medical officer alerted Dr. Fishbein to troubling side effects in the Proleukin trial, namely capillary leak and an unusual psychiatric side effect, suicidal ideation. The medical officer, Larry Fox, worried that NIAID was putting volunteers in danger by withholding the information about those hazards from the investigator brochure as the law required. This brochure is an FDA-mandated document containing updated information detailing, among other things, the side effects and risks of an investigational drug. It provides clinical trial investigators with safety information compiled across study sites to keep study subjects informed about emerging hazards. Furthermore, without an up-to-date document, NIAID had issued the last one in 2000, NIAID was not adequately warning potential clinical trial enrollees about these serious dangers. Recalls Dr. Fishbein, the drug had grave risks for suicidal ideation and capillary leaks. The study leadership was ignoring their legal duty to inform the study recruits and participants about these troubling signals. By this time, NIAID had invested some $36 million in Esprit and had thousands of subjects enrolled at 200 international locations over nearly 4 years. If these asymptomatic participants were to learn about the emerging risks, NIAID feared they would drop out. It would also be difficult to attract new volunteers. The failure to retain subjects or recruit additional volunteers would nullify the study, one of NIAID's most costly ever. Ironically, after 8 years and 4,150 subjects, Esprit concluded Proleukin offered no benefits to clinical outcome in HIV-plus patients. It was now evident to key NIAID officials that Dr. Fishbein was becoming an all-around nuisance. He was professional, curious, incorruptible, and far too serious about performing his duties. His big problem, says Farber, is that he thought his job was legit. Dr. Fishbein's personal virtues were all fatal character flaws within the NIAID institutional culture. Dr. Fishbein's refusal to toe the line sent him stumbling into the terminal career cul-de-sac at NIAID. Dr. Fishbein explained further about the Proleukin trial. It was a serious violation of protocols, and the researchers were ignoring their legal duty to report the signal. They omitted and whitewashed all these safety problems. You can't just focus on efficacy and ignore safety. Dr. Fishbein told AP reporter John Solomon, the ones that were in the study and those that wanted to get in the study, neither were being informed. NIAID feared that if they understood the risks, they would drop out. Dr. Fishbein had entered a dangerous realm at NIAID. He was interfering with ongoing drug approvals. Tremont was angry that Dr. Fishbein was allowing concerns about patient safety to become an obstacle to the agency's central mission of getting new drugs through the approval process with positive reviews. Tremont warned Dr. Fishbein to slow down. You are moving too fast. You need to get to know how this place works, Tremont told him. We need to act more like a pharmaceutical company. We need to get patients and get studies done. In the course of his IL-2 investigation, Dr. Fishbein stumbled on another awkward fact. Anthony Fauci personally owned patents to IL-2 and stood to make millions in royalties if the treatment won FDA approval. Dr. Fishbein was shocked. Dr. Fauci had a personal financial interest in the drug being tested. He was listed as a co-owner on the patent for Proleukin and stood to earn royalties from it. According to little-known HHS rules at that time, NIH employees could collect unlimited royalty payments from drugs they worked on during their agency tenures. Dr. Fishbein found it stunning that Dr. Fauci stood to personally gain significant revenues, providing HHS green-lighted Proleukin. Contemporaneous records obtained by the AP found that some 51 NIH scientists were then involved in testing products for which they secretly receive royalties. Dr. Fauci and his trusty longtime sidekick, Dr. H. Clifford Lane, have received tens of thousands of dollars in royalties for an experimental AIDS treatment they invented, interleukin-2. At the same time, their office has spent millions in tax dollars to test the treatment on patients across the globe. The AP story expressed understandable indignation about the circumstances under which the government has licensed the commercial rights to IL-2 to Chiron Corp. Fauci's division subsequently has spent $36 million in taxpayer money testing the treatment on patients in one experiment alone. Known as the Esprit experiment, it is one of the largest AIDS research projects in NIH history, testing IL-2 on patients at more than 200 sites in 18 countries over the last 5 years. On February 6, 2004, Dr. Fishbein wrote the study executive committee requesting issuance of the long-overdue updated version of the investigator brochure within 60 days to include warnings of the newly discovered risks. Within days, Dr. Fishbein recalled, "I wrote a letter to the executive committee telling them to update the brochure. From that point on, the floor came out below me." Even though his mandate was to enforce research policy, Dr. Fishbein had crossed the red line at NIAID. He was not just interfering with the drug approval process, he was meddling with research in which Fauci had a peculiar interest. Dr. Fishbein's questioning about Dr. Fauci's patents tripped NIH into DEFCON 1. All sorts of alarms went off, recalls Dr. Fishbein. "I came into government very naive. At the very least, I assumed that since Dr. Fauci wanted me to make sure studies were properly done, safety came first and that the participants were protected," he laughed. "I was wrong." He recounts that he had met Dr. Fauci only once, at the interview when Dr. Fauci hired him as NIAID's Chief Ethical and Regulatory Compliance Officer. Dr. Fishbein recalls Dr. Fauci's earnestness. "This is an important job," he said. "If you come across any problems in the agency, I want to hear about them personally. I want you to come directly to me." Dr. Fauci told Dr. Fishbein that his door would always be open. But when Dr. Fishbein asked to meet with him about the IL-2 trials, Dr. Fauci went dark, and Dr. Fishbein felt the institution turning against him. "His guardians said he'd get back to me," recalls Fishbein. "He didn't." He adds, "He basically ran away." In the course of his subsequent grievance procedures and litigation over his firing, Dr. Fishbein obtained emails and other documents that chronicled what happened behind the scenes. Dr. Fauci's principal strategy in discussions with his upper-level management was how to sack Dr. Fishbein while keeping NIAID's director out of the splatter zone when things exploded. On February 24, 2004, Dr. Fauci met with Kagan and Tremont to plan strategies for ridding himself of Dr. Fishbein. The men hatched a plan by which Kagan and Tremont would orchestrate Dr. Fishbein's dismissal while making Dr. Fauci's fingerprints undetectable. The challenge was daunting. All the players knew that Dr. Fauci was the only one with legal authority to fire Dr. Fishbein. NIAID human resources officers originally told Dr. Fishbein that Dr. Fauci had authorized his firing. Dr. Fauci later protested to various investigators from NIH and the U.S. Congress that he had not ordered the firing. The NIH also denied that Dr. Fauci had ordered the firing. Dr. Fishbein calls this statement a lie. "I was a Title 42 special expert, paid outside the agency budget. Dr. Fauci was the only NIAID officer with authority to fire me." Dr. Fishbein's reputation, his integrity, and his sterling work record presented additional obstacles. In November 2003, 3 months before his dismissal, Dr. Fauci presented Dr. Fishbein with a commendation for exceptional work at NIAID. 3 months later, on February 9, 2004, Dr. Tremont also recognized Dr. Fishbein's outstanding job performance by recommending him to receive a $2,500 Service Recognition Award. 5 days later, on February 13, 2004, Kagan blocked the processing of the award and canceled the $2,500 merit prize. DAIDS officials followed these actions with an exchange of frantic emails discussing how to axe Dr. Fishbein without implicating Fauci. In a February 23, 2004 note to Kagan, Tremont said, "John, let's start working on this. Tony, Fauci, will not want anything to come back on us, so we are going to have ironclad documentation. No sense of harassment or unfairness, and, like other personnel actions, this is going to take some work. In Clausewitzian style, we must overwhelm with force. We will prepare our paperwork, then go from there." Several of Dr. Fauci's other trusted subordinates joined the email chain with recommendations for how to blow up Dr. Fishbein's career while keeping Dr. Fauci's hands clean. Said Farber, "Jonathan Fishbein was tarred and feathered for pointing out that the NIH flagship study on Nevirapine was a complete disaster. Fishbein's failure to fall into line, his failure to understand that Nevirapine was too important to fail, meant that the AIDS bureaucracy's neutralizing antibodies had to be activated to destroy him." Between February 14th through 18th, after Tremont notified Dr. Fishbein that he was now reporting to Kagan, the same man whom he had recently cited for disciplinary action, Dr. Fishbein exchanged emails with Tremont, then traveling in Thailand, requesting an explanation for this odd demotion that had him working for a lower-level employee who was a key target of his misconduct investigation. An elusive Tremont refused to explain the decision and answered with a vague remonstration reminiscent of Dr. Fauci's signature obfuscating gobbledygook. "It has not been lost on me that the most complaints about Kagan I heard from our constituents when I arrived revolved around complaints filed by Dr. Fishbein's branch, and since you have arrived, I have not heard a single complaint. And when I have inquired about that, the answer has been the charge brought by you." On February 25, 2004, Kagan canned Dr. Fishbein. Kagan explained to Dr. Fishbein that he had failed in every aspect of his job and that his bosses saw no chance for improvement. Kagan advised Dr. Fishbein to leave DAIDS immediately. Dr. Fishbein opted to stay and fight his dismissal. Dr. Fishbein first wrote to Tremont and Dr. Fauci requesting a meeting. He never received a reply. He next appealed to Dr. Fauci's ostensible boss, NIH Director Elias Zerhouni, who likewise refused to meet with him. NIH banned all employees from speaking about or to Dr. Fishbein. "Everyone was terrified of Fauci," says Dr. Fishbein. "He runs the agency like a vindictive dictator. Everyone is frightened of him. Everyone knows that you never cross Fauci." In Farber's words, Fishbein became a ghost. Nobody addressed him in the corridors, in the elevators, in the cafeteria. "There was an active campaign to humiliate me," he recalls. "It was as if I had AIDS in the early days. I was like Tom Hanks in Philadelphia. Nobody would come near me." On February 26, 2004, Dr. Fishbein met with NIH's Office of Management Assessment, OMA, to complain about the actions against him. OMA also declined to investigate. On March 1, 2004, Dr. Fishbein brought his charges to the HHS Inspector General. The IG similarly refused to lift the carpet at NIH. Later that month, in desperation, Dr. Fishbein moved for whistleblower protection and sought a congressional investigation of the wide-ranging corruption at NIAID. On Capitol Hill, he at last found sympathetic ears. Dr. Fishbein told investigators for United States Senator Charles E. Grassley, Republican, Iowa, and Senator Max Baucus, Democrat, Montana, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee and ranking minority member, respectively, that his sacking was retribution for his reports of wrongdoing in the Naverapin and Proleukin trials. Both senators began clamoring for HHS to investigate Dr. Fauci's corruption charges against NIAID, and to answer the troubling questions Dr. Fishbein had raised about the homicidal studies in Tennessee and Uganda and sexual harassment and mismanagement in NIAID's home office. In a series of stern letters to NIH Director Zerhouni and his boss, HHS Secretary Michael Levitt, Senators Arlen Specter and Herb Cole joined Grassley and Baucus in rebuking NIH for inaction on Dr. Fishbein's complaints. Maryland Congresspersons Representatives Ben Cardin, Barbara Mikulski, and Steny Hoyer signed a similar letter. It's illustrative of Dr. Fauci's overwhelming power that he and his bosses decided to ignore and defy these remonstrances. After all, these three representatives were the royalty of NIH's home state delegation. In May 2004, under pressure from lawmakers, NIH agreed to commission an Institute of Medicine, IOM, investigation of HIV-NET-012. The Institute of Medicine, a branch of the National Academies of Sciences, is ostensibly Congress's independent and trustworthy advisor on scientific issues. IOM regularly assembles panels of top scientists to oversee and review agency science. The presumption is that while regulated industries easily capture and compromise federal agencies, the Institute of Medicine is incorruptible. IOM members do not work for either industry or the government. Congress expects to get the straight poop from IOM. However, by that time, Dr. Fauci had already figured out how to control the IOM with invisible strings. The Capitol Hill lawmakers never realized that Dr. Fauci's PIs dominated the IOM panel that assembled to investigate his wrongdoing. Six of its nine members were NIAID grant recipients, then conducting their own trials for Dr. Fauci, with annual grants ranging from $120,000 to $2 million. The IOM study on Dr. Fishbein's charges was predictably, therefore, yet another whitewash. The IOM panel strategically adopted an extremely narrow scope of investigation that did not include NIAID's outrageous misconduct in Uganda or Tennessee. On April 7, 2004, the IOM panel reported its finding that the HIV-NET-012 data should be considered valid. That same day, Dr. Fishbein received a letter of termination from Tremont. Dr. Fishbein sought and received an automatic postponement of his sacking as he argued his whistleblower case before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Tremont's action, in the middle of a congressional investigation, was a naked gesture of defiance toward NIH's congressional overlords from both political parties. It signaled HHS's resolution to protect Dr. Fauci at any cost and to muzzle criticism by his principal detractor. Teflon Tony had come a long way since 1987, when his public blistering by Congress had left him remorseful and terrified for his future. By 2004, he had the protection of his boss, a powerful Republican president who, thanks to Dr. Fauci, was also implicated in the corrupt HIV-NET trials and who cared little for the distempers of a Democrat-controlled Congress. frustrated and angry at Dr. Fauci's insubordination, Grassley and Baucus fired off a letter dated June 30th to NIH Director Elias A. Zerhouni, demanding an explanation for Dr. Fishbein's firing and accusing NIAID of retaliating against Dr. Fishbein to silence his corruption charges against NIAID. The letter noted that retaliation against an employee for reporting misconduct is unacceptable, illegal, and violates the Whistleblower Protection Act. Meanwhile, a secret internal NIH review of the Nevirapine trials was confirming Dr. Fishbein's worst accusations about Dr. Fauci and HIV-NET. On August 9, 2004, Dr. Ruth Kirchstein, senior advisor to Zerhouni, sent the NIH director the results of her investigation. Kirchstein warned that Dr. Fauci's efforts to fire Fishbein, at the very least, gave the appearance of reprisal. Kirchstein added that it is clear that Dr. Fauci's AIDS branch is a troubled organization and that Dr. Fishbein's complaint is clearly a sketch of a deeper issue. Zerhouni kept quiet about these damning results from the agency's internal investigations. Defying the Senate, he fired Dr. Fishbein on July 4, 2005. Following his dismissal, Dr. Fishbein brought his case before the Merit Systems Protection Board, asserting protection from any official retaliation under federal whistleblower laws. The MSPB reinstated Dr. Fishbein after determining his firing was wrongful retribution. It was clear, however, that Dr. Fishbein had no future at NIH. He negotiated a termination deal. The terms of Dr. Fishbein's settlement agreement with NIAID are secret, and the deal forbids him from discussing its particulars. Dr. Fishbein told me that despite his nominal victory, Dr. Fauci continued to punish him from afar with reverberations reaching far beyond NIAID. "I couldn't get a job in public health for 5 years," Dr. Fishbein says, of Dr. Fauci's vendetta. Everyone in science is terrified of crossing him. He's like a mafia kingpin. He controls everything and everyone in public health. Dr. Fishbein added, "He spreads so much money around, and everyone knows he is vindictive. I had one friend tell me, 'I can't risk hiring you because I can't afford to anger Fauci.'" Says Dr. Fishbein, "This was my first exposure to the cancel culture." He further reminisced, "I left the private sector and took the NIH job because I wanted to do public service, but I was very naive. I believed the government could find solutions and that justice always prevailed. My experience at the Division of AIDS really opened my eyes about how the system really operated. The federal budget is a big trough to feed special interest groups, but if you become wise to it, open your mouth and get on the wrong side of someone really powerful, they are out for blood. The government lawyer is up, and they have unlimited resources to burn you. Truth may not be on their side, but they can throw every obstacle in your way to getting a fair hearing of your grievance. And you can't get justice, because litigation will drain you to your last penny. The system isn't designed to help the aggrieved party. I couldn't coerce Fauci for a deposition. He was too busy doing interviews and accepting awards. There were never any consequences for the perpetrators. They continued merrily in their careers. I had to start all over again. If they are determined to ruin your life, they can do it." Farber is also disenchanted. "They unleash such violence over your whole existence if you cross them. You never walk the same again. They make you feel like you are a dead person, totally devalued. They put a lot of money into these attack campaigns over my article. They went nuclear. Their crusade to discredit and destroy me had lasting impacts on my life. But you know what? I didn't get murdered. Joyce Hafford did. I think of her all the time." And the real losers in that battle, added Farber, were the millions of African women and babies forced to take Nevirapine, a drug that does not prevent AIDS, but sickens and kills people who take it. In the end, Dr. Fauci succeeded in rigging corrupt clinical trials, concealing catastrophic cheating, and deftly manipulating the politics to bring his dangerous and inefficacious drug, Nevirapine, to market. In March 2005, Dr. Valinder Turner, a surgeon at the Department of Health in Perth, Australia, pointed out in a letter to Nature, "None of the available evidence for Nevirapine comes from a trial in which it was tested against a placebo. Yet, as the study's senior author has said, a placebo is the only way a scientist can assess a drug's effectiveness with scientific certainty." Dr. Turner observed that the transmission rate that HIV NET012 reported for HIV, 13.1%, was above the background transmission rate. The HIV NET012 outcome is higher than the 12% transmission rate reported in a prospective study of 561 African women given no antiretroviral treatment. This, in effect, is the placebo group. If anything, then, Dr. Fauci's pet drug has aggravated rather than prevented transmission in all those African babies he was pretending to save. Farber argues that, under Dr. Fauci's leadership, the failure of researchers to properly control with a placebo group is perhaps the outstanding characteristic of AIDS research in general. The statistical gimmick of getting rid of the inert placebo control group would become a tool wielded by Dr. Fauci to gain approvals for hundreds of new drugs and vaccines, from AIDS to COVID. According to Farber, as it was, there was no placebo group, so HIV NET's results are a statistical trick, a shadow play, in which success is measured against another drug and not against an inert placebo, the gold standard of clinical trials. The single beneficial outcome of Dr. Fishbein's ordeal was that congressional and press questions about Dr. Fauci's personal financial stakes in the IL-2 drug forced Dr. Fauci to pledge to donate his royalties from the scheme to charity. HHS thereafter changed its royalty policies a little, limiting royalty payments to contract employees to $150,000 per year, per employee, per patent. In the 30 years since, no member of the media has ever asked Dr. Fauci how much money he made on IL-2 or to which charity, if any, he directed his donations. Nor has Dr. Fauci ever disclosed the extent of his personal stakes or the financial returns from his patents on other NIAID drugs, or the royalty amounts he has rewarded to loyal cronies and underlings at NIAID for the thousands of other new drugs the agency has developed. Finally, during all of Dr. Fauci's tenure at NIH, Dr. Zeke Emanuel was director of the Department of Bioethics, DOB. The Ethical Oversight Board for all of NIH. Emanuel's deputy was Tony Fauci's wife, Christine Grady. In 2012, Grady took over as director of DOB. That department oversees bioethics at clinical trials for all NIH subagencies, including responsibilities for overseeing ethical issues in clinical trials commissioned by her husband, like those for Nevirapine and Proleukin. Grady acknowledged in an interview with Vogue that she was aware of Tony Fauci's reputation as a very scary person upon their first meeting in 1983. Everyone was afraid of him, and when I first saw him, I thought, what are they talking about? He's young, he's handsome, and doesn't seem that scary. Dealing with Tony Fauci is like dealing with organized crime, says Dr. Fishbein. He's like the Godfather. He has connections everywhere. He's always got people that he's giving money to in powerful positions to make sure he gets his way, that he gets what he wants. These connections give him the ultimate power to fix everything, control every narrative, escape all consequence, and sweep all the dirt and all the bodies under the carpet, and to terrorize and destroy anyone who crosses him. Please go to the Children's Health Defense website for the acknowledgments, end notes by chapter, updates to data, and new information that becomes available on any of the subject matter covered in this audiobook.